This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Now that the adult recreational use of marijuana is legal in Connecticut, the work to develop a cannabis industry can begin. The legal sale of weed won't happen until next year. What needs to be in place before dealers can open for business? Joining me now is the state's House Majority Leader, Jason Rojas. He's a Democrat representing parts of East Hartford and Manchester. Representative Rojas, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Certainly. There's a very strong equity component to the Connecticut marijuana law. How did the idea of equity become so prominent in the drafting of the statute that eventually passed?
Right. So, you know, there's been a long-running sentiment that if we're going to move in the direction of creating a regulated legal marketplace for adult-use cannabis, that we should look at the impact and the legacy of the war on drugs over the last, 40, 50 years, going back to the 1970s, and how that disproportionately impacted communities of color. And if we're now going to move in a direction of legalizing something for adult use, how do we atone or address those impacts that we all know too well now, right? The disproportionate number of arrests and how that impacted communities of color, low-income communities. And so if we're going to move forward with this new marketplace, how do we ensure that, one, access to that marketplace is provided to a wide range of individuals who want to enter that marketplace? And two, how do we use the revenue that's generated from this new marketplace to try to address some of the systemic issues that have come from the war on drugs?
The law calls for the...
And just to follow up on that, you know, we saw what other states were doing who before us went in the direction of legalizing adult use cannabis, and how there have been a lot of failed attempts at addressing this question of equity. So that helped inform the process of how we wanted to approach it.
The law calls for the creation of a social equity council, I believe, charged with doing, seems like, most of the heavy lifting of how to make sure the market will address the harm done to the communities that you're talking about, targeted by the war on drugs. Who would be on the equity council?
Yeah, so the equity council will have 11 members, 11 total members, and each of them, each of legislative leaders, as well as the governor's office, as well as the chairperson of the Black and Puerto Rican caucus, including Republican leaders as well. In the bill, they were all given appointments to this equity council. And even within those appointments, each of the individuals with appointing authority should be looking to fill a certain requirement. So the majority leader's appointment, right? The individual who I appoint should have a background of at least 5 years working in economic development to help minority-owned businesses. So we were kind of intentional about the kind of people and the kind of expertise that we wanted to be present on this council as they go about implementing and making decisions about what this marketplace is going to look like.
How would the council operate?
It would be, you know, just like many councils and commissions that exist within state government. It would be housed within a state agency over at the Department of Economic and Community Development. It would, you know, operate just like a state agency would, right? So subject to all the state laws, FOI requirements, and, you know, as DCP lays out the licensing process, there'll be 9 different types of licenses that can be created. As DCP goes about lining those up, there will then be a lottery process by which individuals will apply to become a cannabis-related retailer or operator of some kind. And obviously there's an equity component to that. So we'll have a lottery for equity applicants, and then there'll be a lottery for all other non-equity applicants. And they go about working through that process, determining and evaluating the individuals who apply to become an operator of some kind, whether it's a transporter, whether it's food and beverage, whether it's production, whether it's a cultivator or a retailer, any of those types of entities. That commission would help inform the process in terms of validating and verifying what's been presented to them in terms of an application. Does the person have financing lined up? Does the person have a physical location in which to locate their business? Have they gone through zoning? Do they meet all the criminal background checks that are required of it? All those kinds of things that were included in the bill would be vetted by that particular council.
They're supposed to start work on the 1st of August, is that right? The Equity Council?
Right, yeah. So it's a very ambitious timeline for us.
I wanted to ask you about that timeline because, as I understand it, their suggestions for policies regarding the Connecticut marijuana industry are due by the first of the new year, January 1st. Is that really enough time to craft a structure and hammer out all the details for this new industry?
There's so many deadlines. Yes. Yeah, they're supposed to do a study basically, of the industry. I mean, so the study is a little bit different than the process of standing up
I see.
Industry. But that study that we're asking them to submit by January 1 is really to, it's kind of a disparity study, right? And the disparity study was required of us to potentially take some other actions that we might want to take in the future in terms of how we determine who an equity applicant is. But what's due January 1st is an analysis by that equity council about, you know, how do we ensure that individuals that were harmed, disproportionately harmed, have equal access to those licenses, specifying perhaps additional qualifications to determine what a social equity applicant is, how are we going to provide for an expedited process for those applicants, minimum criteria. So we think there's enough work to get that study done. In the meantime, the respective agencies that are responsible for implementation, they've already begun their work, and they're going to begin laying out the licensing process over the summer so that they can open up for applications sometime late summer, early fall, with the goal of adult use sales taking place. You know, for the whole year, we've been using May. We're probably at the point of a late summer, early fall, actual opening up for retail sales.
You started to mention that the timeline is on the ambitious side.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it is, right. So that's why there's no hard and fast date for when actual sales will take place. We know it'll be sometime next summer. And anytime you go around with implementation of public policy, there are things that even as lawmakers, we couldn't anticipate in the drafting process that will come up. And fortunately, the timelines allows for us that we do have a legislative session next February through May where we can make any adjustments as needed.
There will be a limit to the number of licenses given out for these new businesses, correct? How will the state calculate that number?
Well, we didn't set any limits on the number of licenses. We figured that would be something that would be best done through the regulatory process and allow DCP to look at the marketplace and determine exactly how many licenses are needed. You know, how much demand is there? How much capacity is there on the cultivation side? You know, we did include provisions in there to ensure that the medical marketplace is taken care of first before the adult marketplace is taken. So we haven't set any limits. You know, we did look at some data based on how New Jersey was looking at it and how Massachusetts was looking at it and kind of extrapolating the population of Massachusetts, the number of dispensaries they need, what the demand is going to be. And then so we have a rough number of what we think we'll need, at least in terms of retailers. Cultivation is a bit more trickier because we have current cultivators who can expand, but we also expect some new cultivators to enter the marketplace too.
I tried to understand as much of the bill as I could by reading a summary, which was much shorter than the 300-page bill itself.
Interesting. Well, even the summary was about 200 pages, right? So it wasn't much shorter, but 100 pages shorter, sure.
It was certainly a lot to digest. I totally agree with that. So some of these thoughts may be questions may be a bit off the mark, and you'll correct me on these, I'm sure, if you will. What percentage of the licenses, given that we don't know exactly what the number might be, will be connected to communities or people directly impacted by the war on drugs?
Yeah, so we set aside 50% of all new licenses would go for equity applicants, and then 50% would be for non-equity. And, you know, states have used different numbers. There's been 60-40, 30-70. We arrived at a 50-50 number.
One of the numbers that I saw, I believe I saw in the summary, said that one dispensary per, or one retail outlet per 25,000 population.
Right.
How does that fit into the equation, and is that accurate?
Yeah, right. That was a debate that we had, again, amongst the negotiators as well. What we didn't want to do was have an over-concentration of these kinds of operators, particularly the retailers, in any one community. So at least at the outset, we wanted to set kind of a minimum or a maximum number that could take place. So we arrived, you know, we went from 15,000 to 20,000 up to 25,000, but only allowing for one for each 25,000. And I'm sure that's a number that will adjust as we get a better understanding about what the marketplace looks like.
I'm talking with Connecticut House Majority Leader Jason Rojas, Democrat representing parts of East Hartford and Manchester, someone who was involved directly in crafting the new marijuana bill in Connecticut that is now law. He helped craft the measure. It was signed into law by the governor recently. According to the law, again, based on the summary that I read, each licensed producer will have to contribute $500,000 to the Equity Council. And that money will go towards a program to help social equity applicants open micro-cultivator businesses. If that's correct, what's the idea there? More established operations providing seed money to essentially develop a cottage industry in black and brown communities?
Yeah, you know, right now we know that the current marketplace on the medical side is overrepresented by wealthy individuals or individuals who have easier access to capital. So what we wanted to do was ensure that they had a stake in ensuring that we arrive at this goal of ensuring equity in the marketplace. So we felt it's already been a lucrative place for a lot of the medical operators as they seek to convert now to over to hybrid, a hybrid operator, whether a hybrid cultivator or a hybrid dispensary. We know that a significant amount of money has been made in this business, and there's a significant amount of money in the future to be made. And given that they've the benefit that they've had, again, you know, and then this isn't to punish them, right? They followed all the rules and entered the medical marketplace as the way that we were required them under the law. I think there was a lot less emphasis placed on equity back when the medical marketplace was stood up. And we also recognize it takes a lot of money to get into this business. So it was really limited in that way. And we wanted to ensure that we can have the resources that we need to support some of these perhaps undercapitalized or lesser capitalized individuals who want to enter that marketplace, find ways to support them. So that can be no interest loans, grants, technical assistance. How do we provide those types of services to people who want to get into this marketplace? And part of that was allowing these individuals to pay into that equity fund to help us support other individuals.
So you don't think that contribution number, that $500,000, will limit the types of entrepreneurs who can participate in the industry?
Well, that's for only existing ones who want to convert, right? The actual fees for somebody to enter the marketplace are considerably lower. You know, to get into the lottery, depending on the type of license, it's in a couple $100s. When you get to a provisional license, so once you've been vetted to some degree by the equity council, there's a provisional license that you can apply for. That's in the range of a couple $1,000s. And then when you get to the final license so that you can open up, it's in, you know, it ranges, but it's in the 10 of thousands or 25,000, depending on what you're trying to operate. So not insignificant amount of money, but certainly far more doable than a $500,000 number. Or if you're looking at the conversion fee for the current operators and or dispensaries, for the cultivators, it's a $3 million conversion fee. For the dispensaries, it's $1
million. What's your feeling about the demand for licenses? Robust? Do you feel like there'll be a line around the block, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, I mean, based on what we've seen in other states, there are certainly a lot of interest in these types of licenses and opening. You know, we've seen an explosion of growth in this industry across the country, where there's almost 400,000 jobs now in cannabis-related employment. And obviously, there's a lot of revenue to be made. So I suspect that there will be a lot of interest in getting at these licenses. I've certainly had people that I know ask me about what the process is going to be, and I've had to direct them to the Department of Consumer Protection website, which isn't fully built out, but they do have an adult use cannabis website, and they expect to start populating that website with information as we get through the summer and into the fall.
Local governments will have the right to ban retail sales within their borders. Prospect, I think, is a town that is doing that already. Any idea what percentage of the state's 169 cities and towns might opt out?
Yeah, hard to tell. I mean, you know, even in the case of Prospect, they put a moratorium for the next 6 months on retail sales, even though retail sales don't even begin until next year, right? So I think there's some confusion, perhaps a lack of understanding about the bill. I certainly understand, you know, the concerns they might have about something like this taking place in their community. But even if they ban a retailer, the law still allows delivery to take place within that community. And certainly an individual can go shop in the next town over. So, you know, I think each town will have to explore the opportunity cost of banning these types of retailers from locating in their communities or not. But, you know, really impossible to tell exactly how many will go that. There are some communities that are going through the process of evaluating it. I don't know that they're going into it with the intent of banning. I think like everybody, they're just trying to learn a little bit more about the process and what it's going to look like and what are the potential impacts, I think both positive and potentially negative, of what it might have on their community.
Do you think that uncertainty will impact, affect, or inhibit the work that the Social Equity Council is going to be doing in the next, 6 to 8 months?
I think there's a potential for that, right? I mean, if too many communities choose to ban exactly or ban these types of industries from locating in their communities, where does that leave us? What does that mean for that threshold number of one for 25,000? Will that have to be adjusted so that we can ensure that we can have a marketplace that meets demand? We certainly don't want to have shortages of any kind if there's a lot of demand for it. And, you know, as we've seen in Massachusetts, like anything, like when Krispy Kreme opened up 10, 12 years ago, right, there was a line down the street for donuts. I suspect the same thing will happen with cannabis-related businesses. And probably a month or 2 months or 3 months, it'll be kind of normal. And, you know, it'll be like something you get used to. It'll be like, oh, there's Krispy Kreme and there's no line any longer for donuts, right?
They showed up at our front door with a dozen donuts when they first opened. So that was interesting. I'm not suggesting anything similar here, but you know what I mean. You know, it's interesting, too, I think, using a business model here to attempt to right a social, racial, and economic injustice. Do you think that'll be enough to make up for what happened to people during the war on drugs?
No, you know, I don't know that there's anything that we can do to completely atone for what happened on the war on drugs, right? You know, once somebody's been incarcerated and their life has been impacted in such a way where it's hard to find employment, it's hard to maintain your dignity, it's difficult to find housing. I don't know how you make up for that, but that doesn't mean we still shouldn't try to do all that we can to try.
Representative Rojas, thanks so much for your time today and your insights about how this potentially complicated marijuana law in Connecticut will work. We appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me and the opportunity to educate your listening.
Representative Jason Rojas, Majority Leader in the Connecticut House, a Democrat representing parts of East Hartford and Manchester, Connecticut. We're talking about the new legal marijuana businesses that will soon open in both Connecticut and New York. But these shops, yet to come, will not be the first selling cannabis-based products in our region. Entrepreneurs have developed businesses that sell related legal products like CBD oils, for example, for therapeutic uses. And joining me now are two of these business people. From New Haven, Connecticut, we have Kiebra Smith-Bolden. She's the founder of Canna Health CT. And also David Falkowski from Bridgehampton, Long Island, the owner and founder of Open Mind Organics. Ms. Smith-Bolden and Mr. Falkowski, welcome to The Full Story.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. I'd like to ask you both, first of all, how you became, I guess you would say, cannabis entrepreneurs. Ms. Smith-Bolden, if you could start us off, how did you get into the business?
Sure. So I am a registered nurse and have always worked in the community. So I've been very community healthcare focused all of my career. But in 2012, my grandmother suffered an aneurysm and it devastated her mind and body. And we ended up medicating her with cannabis and saw such a complete turnaround in her overall health status. I mean, she wasn't walking. She was wheelchair bound. She started walking with a walker when we introduced cannabis into her medication regimen. She started talking. Her mood improved. Her ability to participate in therapies improved. And so I just really was amazed by the turnaround, and that was what I could contribute it to. And so I decided to study cannabis. I found a school in Massachusetts, and I learned all about the medicine, the science, how cannabis is used to manage symptoms. And I also, you know, I grew up in New Haven, as you mentioned. Oh, well, my business is in New Haven, but I'm born and raised in New Haven as well, which is very much an inner city. And I had always known about cannabis. Well, you know, back then I was referred to it as weed most of the time, but never looked at it as medicine. And then I also was able to put together, you know, the dots, connect the dots with the war on drugs and how to use the criminalization of this plant to oppress and disenfranchise my community. And so I wanted to be a part of providing medical access to plant-based medicine to people in my community who don't usually choose a plant-based route. And I also wanted to provide education and knowledge for people to engage in this industry and fight and advocate for communities that were destroyed during the war on drugs to be able to participate in this industry and have the benefit of the revenue that comes from this industry.
And I want to make sure people understand the kind of business that you're running. Obviously, legal sellers of marijuana have not opened any businesses as of yet. The law is brand new in Connecticut. What kind of products do people find in your business?
So, Canna Health, we are a medical service provider. So we certify people for medical cannabis in the state of Connecticut, mm-hmm. or AKA get them their medical marijuana cards or their weed card. Some people have referred to it as. So I hire doctors and advanced practice registered nurses to evaluate and assess those who would like to use cannabis as a form of medication to help to manage symptoms of over 30 qualifying conditions here in the state of Connecticut. And so we've been established since 2017 and have certified and added thousands of Connecticut patients to the Connecticut Medical Marijuana Program. But we don't actually touch the plant. We do have some CBD products, but overall our service is strictly providing medical certification.
And Mr. Falkowski, I understand you began by growing mushrooms, not the psychedelic variety, however. Could you tell us how you got into this business?
Sure. So, yeah, I started nearly 20 years ago now as a sort of acolyte of Paul Stamets and growing organic, gourmet, medicinal mushrooms in my backyard. And through the years, I diversified the business. And in the late summer of 2017, a gentleman approached me on my farm and started talking about cannabis medicine and opportunities coming in New York. And there's always been some stuff rumbling around in the background, bills and policy, but he said CBD. And it was kind of like the first time I ever heard this really out loud in my hometown here. And he said, New York is going to be opening up licenses for hemp farmers. And then he kind of disappeared out of my life. But lo and behold, at that time, I went and I looked, and New York State had opened up another round of licensing for hemp cultivators and, most importantly, processors. And I put out an application, and I was awarded a license. Our plant's in the ground in 2018. We've been growing 3,000 to 4,000 pounds a year since then and processing these hemp plants into hemp oil, CBD oils, CBG oils, et cetera. And we are vertically integrated. And this is alongside all the clean food that we grow. This is alongside different mushroom and herbal extracts that we make also. So we've always been about wellness and health in the community, and this was a natural extension for us.
And from a business perspective, what was response that you got from your customers and the community on Long Island in Bridgehampton when you introduced cannabis-based products?
So for myself, and I'll always be honest, we were very fortunate in that I had an existing business for 15 years, and I developed a relationship of trust, quality, and transparency with all of our other work. As a matter of fact, there was a handful of people that literally said, you know, we're grateful that it's you because we already trust you, versus it being another startup company that people don't know about. And I have to admit, you know, with that experience and my position in the community, that trust that we've built, we're very well received. Across all sorts of bases.
Ms. Smith-Bolden, when you opened your clinic in New Haven, what kind of a reception did you receive from the neighborhood?
I think it's very similar to what he just mentioned. Having worked in the community as a nurse, providing health care and services to people who lived in some of the worst, and I'm putting up air quotes, communities in New Haven, I was already a trusted healthcare provider. And so it was a pretty smooth transition. People believed what I was sharing with them. I was able to provide information and a new way to look at medicine and medicating or helping people who are already consuming cannabis understand that really what they were doing was self-medicating and helping them to do that in a more efficient, responsible way was really important. And so I really had great reception to those who had encountered my business and wanted to be certified. As a professional nurse, I definitely ran into some difficulties in my profession. So I was doing this and working at the same time. And 5 years ago, the sentiment wasn't what it is now. People weren't so open to the idea of cannabis. And so it was a challenge in that regard. But the support was pretty tremendous for Canna Health. And again, we've been certifying and recertifying patients for years now and have a really nice flow of both new and returning patients.
I was just about to ask you what the most challenging part is about running a marijuana-based clinic.
I would say that the most challenging part is helping people to feel comfortable, you know, especially in communities of color, inner city communities. When people have talked about cannabis or marijuana or weed, it's always been like in the dark, you know, quietly because of the fear of criminality. And so really helping people to understand that Canna Health is a safe place and that they're able to be open and honest and that we are there to help and support them through the process. I would say that has been the most difficult part. Like I had people coming up to me, what do I have to say? You know, whispering, what do I have to say to get a cannabis card? And I'm like, just say the truth. Because the number one diagnosis we see in our clinic is PTSD. Mm-hmm. So we're assessing and diagnosing people with post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's really personal, like revealing your traumas and having to talk about that. So providing an environment with culturally competent care from a trusted health provider that has a footprint and has worked in the community has helped overcome those challenges.
Mr. Falkowski, what kind of challenges have you run into in running your marijuana-based business?
Being on the touch side, being cultivators of cannabis, obviously in the hemp swing lane, and manufacturers, processors, big challenges have been insurance policies, bank accounts, credit card merchants. And then, so that's just like basic business stuff. And then really the complexities of this term compliance. You know, when I first started down this road in cannabis and the legal side, I didn't really understand at that time what compliance meant. And it's reports, licenses, fees, facility upgrades, audits, just all these extraneous fees and burdensome regulations that you need to meet and satisfy that really the average business owner in another sector really doesn't have to deal with. So it's really because of the federal status of cannabis, CBD, marijuana, which complicates compliance with insurance companies and banking institutions, and then this overlay of what is cannabis compliance. Those are the largest burdens that we have.
I'm speaking with Kibra Smith-Bolden, the founder of Canna Health CT in New Haven, Connecticut, also with David Falkowski from Bridgehampton, Long Island. He's the owner and founder of Open Mind Organics. I'd like to ask both of you, did you play a role in crafting the new laws in Connecticut and New York? Mr. Falkowski?
I'd like to say proudly that I've been tapped as the chairman for the Long Island Committee for the New York Cannabis Growers Processors Association. I sit on the Hemp and Commodities Work Group with New York Farm Bureau. And I'd like to think as part of larger coalition efforts that many of us fought, you know, to make sure the legislation is what New York needs. I mean, obviously, the legislators did the brunt of it, but behind the scenes, you know, we were here pushing locally, having meetings with our local officials, and in some cases, you know, offering suggestions on what some of the legislation should read. So definitely felt part of this coalition effort to bring this monumental legislation to light.
Ms. Smith-Bolden, were you connected at all? Were you involved with the crafting of the new law in Connecticut?
Very much so. For the last few years, I was one of the leading, the only advocate, a black woman, definitely, who was instrumental in educating legislators, educating the community, talking to legislators who brought forth cannabis bills to make sure that they had social equity included in them and that there was community reinvestment included in the bills and that there was opportunities for people to have records expunged and be able to restart their lives. So I served as president of Connecticut United for Reform and Equity, and we basically just helped to draft policy and educate the community, and you know, we were present at all of the public hearings And it was really interesting in this last year, of course, because due to COVID, everything was virtual. And so I think it actually gave more people an opportunity to use their voice. And so we were able to make sure that people knew about opportunities to testify. And yes, we definitely provided language. And then ultimately that information was pulled into the governor's bill and the final bill that we were able to put out, and that was enacted July 1st. I am very proud to say that in collaboration with CURE, Jason Ortiz, Lou Vega, Joe LaChance, the Connecticut Normal, the Connecticut Canna Warriors, Cody Roberts, Joe Raymond, these were all leading advocates who made this legislation happen, and I'm so proud to have been a part of it. I'm proud of the work that we did. It still is a lot more to go. You know, we have a lot further to go, and there's more details to deal with, but I'm really proud of the direction in which we're going, and I think we're going to be leaders nationally in social equity here in Connecticut.
Now, it will be a while before the retail shops open in both Connecticut and New York. I'm wondering, this new Connecticut law that legalizes the use of recreational marijuana for 21 and older, will that change at all the way you do business?
Well, I definitely think that there will be a bit of a decline. You know, some people who were consuming cannabis were going through the medical program to provide safeties, you know, from being criminalized and things of that nature. And so those people can now engage in the activity of consumption of cannabis without having that medical card. However, there are still protections specifically for medical cannabis patients, and benefits. So, for instance, if you enroll in the medical cannabis program, even with the adult use program, medical patients can grow their own cannabis. Medical patients will pay less taxes, and medical patients will have more options as far as dispensaries that provide both medical and adult use. They'll have more options of where they would like to purchase their cannabis.
Mr. Falkowski, do you think the New York law, the new New York law, will have an impact on your business?
It most definitely will. In New York, you know, we're in a precarious situation because the law has been passed. We have the statute, you know, that's legalized marijuana, so you can smoke it anywhere. You can smoke a cigarette. You can walk around in a public space with 3 ounces in your pocket. You can have 5 pounds at home. But we don't have a cannabis control board yet, this board of 5 members who are going to write the regulations that give us the answers to a lot of these big questions. So there's, you know, a lot of nail-biting right now. Most indubitably, though, it's going to change things. You know, for me personally, the biggest question is, am I going to be able to maintain my vertical integration where we grow our cannabis certified organically, we process it certified organically in a cGMP audited lab, and then we sell it at our own retail locations and or wholesale it. But there are no regulations that have fleshed all of this out. So it most definitely will change how we do business. We're just waiting for this board to be seated, which can actually only be done while the legislators are in session, and they left session a few weeks ago. So New York's in an interesting place right now.
As you've both suggested, there's still quite a bit of work to be done before the retail shops open, despite the new laws legalizing the use of recreational marijuana in both Connecticut and New York have been signed and are now part of law. I appreciate both of you spending some time with us today, letting us know how your businesses are operating and might be affected by the new law. Ms. Smith-Bolden, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this conversation.
Certainly. And Mr. Falkowski, also thank you for being on the program today.
Hey, it's my honor. Thank you for your time.
Certainly. So how will the newly expanded cannabis industry fit into the Connecticut business puzzle? We've asked the Associate Counsel for Business, Law, Energy, and Workers' Compensation at the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, or CBIA, to help us understand that. His name is John Blair, and he joins us now on the phone. Mr. Blair, welcome.
I'm grateful to have the opportunity. Thank you for having me on.
Certainly. Is the new law legalizing the adult use of recreational marijuana good for business in Connecticut?
It kind of cuts both ways. As an organization, we didn't necessarily support or support the overall passage of the legislation. We were focused on making sure there were employer protections in the law. Mm-hmm. Now that the law has been passed, we're spending quite a bit of time determining, you know, how these businesses will be established and their economic, the economic engine that they will create as a result of having this passed. I think it will have a positive impact.
On the CBIA website, there's an article that explains how the new law actually prohibits the sale of any hemp-based products that contain a total THC concentration that exceeds 0.3% on a dry weight basis. So that sounds rather complicated, but THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana, does this law now restrict the sale of these products?
I think what they did was, like the law itself for the passage of marijuana, is giving the ability to the regulators to, you know, more carefully regulate the levels of THC. And so I think this helps wrap the hemp growers that grow that have THC within their strains, mm-hmm. To be more in compliance with what the new law would be.
Hmm. What other challenges do you think this new law presents to potential marijuana entrepreneurs, those who want to sell the recreational type?
Well, the barriers that I see is that, look, there is, the law has to still define what control of an entity is by a social equity applicant. They have to define how many numbers of licenses that are going to actually sell. They are trying to make sure that they are requiring that 50% of those that do get licensed are social equity applicants, at least 50% for general applicants. So there's a split between the two. So that's a little bit different than other states. Other states haven't reserved that much percentage for social equity applicants, but I think that's kudos to the legislature for doing that. I think other states have recognized that part was well done. But I think they didn't create a lot of barriers to entry other than having to get your license and qualify and be able to put up the money to the $500,000 to enter the market.
I've been wondering about the difference between legal marijuana, recreational marijuana in Connecticut, and the way the federal government looks at recreational marijuana, still classifying it as a banned substance, I believe. It's confusing, and I wonder if this conflict makes running a hemp-based business, I guess anywhere, but certainly in Connecticut, just difficult navigating the differences in the laws.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's been a struggle across the country with regards to the passage of laws that allow for recreational cannabis, because as we all know, that it's still a banned substance at the federal level, and banks are federally regulated entities. However, in 2014, the U.S. Treasury put out a guidance to allow for banks and credit unions to do banking with cannabis providers. And that guidance, though, is basically puts the banks into such levels of compliance and regulatory oversight, you know, such things as, you know, looking into SARs, which is the suspicious activity reports. Even though they have to file them on a regular basis, but for cannabis, the amount of filings for those are so cumbersome that most banks don't participate in it. But what we should know is that you can do banking. It's just there's a lot of compliance activities for banks, and only 4 out of 146 banks in the state of Connecticut actually participate with growers.
As a very large organization representing and dealing with businesses all over the state, do you at the CBIA anticipate getting questions, requests for help in navigating business laws and whatnot from marijuana entrepreneurs in the future?
Through the process of the legislation, the only area in which CBIA got itself involved in was on the employer protection side, making mm-hmm. sure there are employer protections and maintained safe workplaces. We weren't involved in the decision-making around social equity partnerships, joint ventures, and the actual establishment of how to become an entrepreneur. However, we are getting a litany of questions of how this will work. And our answer to date has been is to be determined. That they had hoped to have, by the end of 2022 is the first time that they're thinking that they will actually sale, manufacture, and cultivation of cannabis, just due to the regulatory hurdles that need to be decided before we get there. So, yeah, we are getting a lot of questions, but it's difficult to provide real detailed guidance. The detailed guidance will come from that Social Equity Council and from the Department of Consumer Protection and the Department of Economic and Community Development. There's a social equity board that's being put together. It's a 15-member board. It's right now the folks like the Speaker of the House, Senate President Pro Tem, are making appointments to that, and that group will actually be the one to really put the parameters around the recreational cannabis here in the state of Connecticut.
Lots of work left to do before the doors actually open for business then.
Yeah, we need a lot more clarification. We can't really advise folks until there's actually some regulations passed and until the council really gets established and begins heading down the mission of what they need to do in order to make this work in Connecticut.
Mr. Blair, thanks for your time today and your insights on this new law and how it affects business in Connecticut. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for your time, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. John Blair is Associate Counsel focusing on business, law, energy, and workers' compensation at CBIA. Lawmakers in Connecticut and New York are creating structures for new marijuana businesses, which have been authorized recently in both states. It'll be a while before shops actually open for business. So what should would-be cannabis entrepreneurs be doing now to get into the game, to get ready for that game? Let's ask Dr. Fred Warren McKinney. He is the Carlton Highsmith Chair for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Quinnipiac University School of Business. Professor, welcome back to The Full Story.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be back. And this is a really important topic that we're talking about today.
Yeah, we're looking forward to your insights. You've been following the development of the Connecticut law over the years. From an entrepreneurial perspective, what's your assessment of what lawmakers have put on the books?
Well, I'm a big fan of legalization, and I probably go beyond what most people think. I'm actually in favor of legalization of all substances, but marijuana is a good place to start. I think what you're seeing in a number of states is really as recently as yesterday. New Jersey announced that it was expunging the sentences, the convictions of 88,000 people. So, there's a social dynamic to this as well as sort of the legalization issue. And the two intersect when it comes to entrepreneurship, because I think there's an opportunity here with legalization. There will be whether it's substantial or not kind of depends on your perspective, but there will be a large number of potential jobs created by the legalization of marijuana, and those will be retail type jobs. One of the things that I've done in my travels around the country is to kind of take a look at these retail establishments that where you do have legal marijuana. So I visited stores in Oregon this summer. I was in Colorado. I've been to California. And, of course, in Massachusetts, it's close. So I've been to stores in all four of those states where recreational marijuana is legal. One of the things that I concluded from those visits of stores around the country is that these are small businesses, but they are not exclusively small businesses. So you have some businesses that are pretty substantial and require a fair amount of capital to have the retail footprint that the entrepreneurs are trying to establish. So, these are not, I think we have to dispel people of the notion that these are mom-and-pop operations that you can start with $5,000. That's not going to happen. You can do it, but you probably are not going to survive. So these are businesses that need capital. And so my advice to would-be marijuana entrepreneurs is to make sure you treat this like a real business, with a real business plan, with the possibility that you might lose money for several months or even several years before you start turning a profit. And in order to do that, you need capital to survive those rocky starts and the mistakes that inevitably will be made by entrepreneurs that are new in an industry. So, you know, I think that my first comment would be that entrepreneurs need to beware. They need to act like entrepreneurs and understand that there are risks associated with this business, just like if they were to start any business.
In addition to the retail type of business, it seems that there would be other kinds of businesses as well, growing, product production, that sort of thing. Absolutely. Do you see opportunity in those areas?
Yes, and I do. I mean, Connecticut is kind of ironic. Connecticut had a fairly large tobacco farming business that was, you know, making the wrappers for cigars for generations up in the, you know, north of Hartford area. Most establishments have shut down in recent years, but, you know, you could imagine that there could be a thriving, growing business here. As well, it will be indoor grow, but that's kind of what's taking place in places like Colorado and Oregon as well. So it's possible. And, you know, you're also going to have a fight for markets and market share where, you know, although you can think about establishing, say, a growing operation in the state of Connecticut, the question is, can you be competitive? And what are the laws that are going to exist, are going to be developed that will determine the ability of, say, the retailers to buy nationally, or will they be restricted to buy from local farms? So, you know, I think a lot of that's going to be determined because if, you know, for it makes a difference when it comes to sort of border markets. And so you can imagine if you've got a shop in Connecticut and a shop in Springfield, the pricing is going to be important as to who gets the business. And if pricing is important, that means cost is important. So there are going to be, some things that we don't know right now how it's going to shake out, but these are going to be factors in the determination of who is going to be ultimately successful at this business. But, you know, in addition to growing, there's going to be a whole other set of businesses that are going to develop around this industry. There are going to be many people who just simply don't want to go to the store. I mean, we are in a post-COVID environment where people are used to Uber Eats. So you could, you know, what's going to happen is you're going to have marijuana eats, where people are going to get into the business of delivering marijuana from legal stores to people's homes. Saves you the trip, and I think there are going to be a lot of people who are going to take that route.
It seems on the surface, and I did want to ask you as well if you were involved in helping to shape this law. It seems on the surface pretty complicated. Just reading through it. Like potential business owners, regardless of which part of the business they decide to get involved with, would need, I don't know, consultants and lawyers to do things correctly.
Yes. Yeah, there's a huge, you know, legal difference between this because of the current federal treatment of marijuana. And that's why you're having all of these discussions in Washington right now. You know, and even at the Supreme Court level, Clarence Thomas has opined that, you know, maybe it's time to change the marijuana laws. But those federal laws impact this industry in significant ways because of banking. And so banks right now, commercial banks, are not allowed to process these marijuana transactions if they are federally licensed. And so most banks in the state, the large banks, are, you know, have some kind of federal charter. So this is this creates some legal issues and the need for lawyers. This also creates security concerns because if this is a cash business, in the early days of Colorado, I mean, you had the successful early retailers in Colorado, you know, driving their cash around in armored vehicles with ex-Marines as guards to keep their stash of cash, you know, safe. And it's a mess. I mean, we've got to make this industry fully legal in the sense that these transactions can run through existing financial organizations and banks.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Warren McKinney about the business of the marijuana business, now legal in Connecticut, but no shops have opened just yet. That'll take some time. Dr. McKinney, I'm wondering, too, have any of your students, you do have classes on the collegiate level, do any of your students ask you about starting the marijuana business themselves, a business themselves?
Yeah, I've talked to several students who are interested in the cannabis business and different aspects of cannabis business. I mean, I've had some students that were interested in cannabis not as a recreational drug, but for the other properties of cannabis. I mean, cannabis is a substance that's been used for centuries to make things like clothes and rope. I mean, George Washington grew cannabis. So, you know, this is there are opportunities. I've talked to several students. They are interested. They're curious. In fact, they were so curious that I tried to get one of the marijuana entrepreneurs in Massachusetts to come down to Quinnipiac to give a talk, but they were too busy.
Well, so, I guess that says something about the business potential right there.
Right. No, it's I mean, I think that there's if you look at what many of the analysts are saying about the industry right now, you're looking at an industry that on the legal side is about an $18 billion industry. And that's with about 16 states that are legal for recreational purposes. There are about 36 states that are legal for recreation and medical purposes. And so the projections show that in the next 10 years, that the $18 billion could possibly grow to over $50 billion. And in 20 years, this is probably a $100 billion industry. And if you look at, you know, Connecticut, the math is pretty easy because, you know, Connecticut's about 1% of the U.S. population. And so if you just take 1% of these numbers, and so you know if it's 50 billion nationally within the next 10 years, you know, you're looking at a $500 million business in Connecticut, which is significant. And that's just on the retail side. That's not all the ancillary stuff. And so if you translate that into jobs, and again, these are going to be retail jobs, and you make some assumptions about, you know, average wages of these retail workers in cannabis, and even if you assume that it's, you know, $40,000 or $50,000 a year for the average worker in the cannabis industry, you know, you're looking at upwards of 10 to 15,000 employees in Connecticut that could be working in cannabis. Now, you know, I think that's where there's also this opportunity to provide employment for people who previously, you know, spent time in jail for doing now what's legal, which is to sell cannabis.
It sounds like the business of running a cannabis business is something that will be integrated into the classroom in the not-too-distant future when we're talking about how to be a successful entrepreneur.
Yes. In fact, in California, you already have, you know, again, pre-pandemic, you had schools that were being set up to help would-be entrepreneurs in cannabis to learn various aspects of the business from, you know, the business side, but also the legal side, but also the agricultural side. So, I mean, there are skills that are unique to any business, and there will be skills unique to the cannabis business. And, you know, the business has some interesting parallels. I mean, there are parallels between cannabis and, say, coffee. And you know, one of the things I noticed in my visits around the country to cannabis stores is that really the higher-end stores – you know, if you closed your eyes and didn't know what was being sold, you could be in, you know, the best outfitted Starbucks retail outlet or even an Apple store. I mean, that's the kind of money that the entrepreneurs are putting into their storefronts.
Last year, before the pandemic hit, and you touched on this earlier when you mentioned about what New Jersey has done this week, expunging records of people with certain kinds of marijuana convictions. You wrote an opinion piece before the pandemic for the Connecticut Post titled On Marijuana, Race, and Connecticut. And in your op-ed, you wrote, I submit that having a conviction on your record for marijuana, or any drug for that matter, is a life sentence of economic poverty, family instability, recidivism, and a life of criminality. This new Connecticut law does have a social equity component to it, but so does New York's for that matter. The Connecticut law says it will implement, quote, equitable marketplace requirements under which at least half of all initial licenses are reserved for social equity applicants, targeting those communities that have been most negatively impacted by the so-called war on drugs, end quote. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you, can business truly right this wrong?
It's going to be hard. I mean, the problem is that I like the intention of this, to reserve the part of the market for people who have suffered from the regime of illegality. But the problem is the people who have suffered don't have the capital to establish the types of businesses that I'm talking about. At least most don't. And so I think this is going to require some very interesting partnerships that, have to be real. But there will be some. And I'm not sure how many you're going to get. I'm not as optimistic that you're going to be able to do what the state wants to do here at the level that the state wants to do. That's not to say it shouldn't be done. I think it should be done. But I think it's going to be just difficult to find the entrepreneurs who can do this successfully.
Professor, thanks so much for your time. We'll be checking back in with you in the near future as the state, Connecticut, figures out just how to open up these businesses for all those who want to be entrepreneurs when it comes to cannabis.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Dr. Fred Warren McKinney is the Carlton Highsmith Chair for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Quinnipiac University's School of Business. How about you? Are you thinking of starting a marijuana-based business? Tell us about that. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org or on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. Sit for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.